It's unbelievable. Online, the mood ranged from despondent, we are done, guess he was vincible after all, to guardedly hopeful. Some sick part of me is excited to see KD go into hero mode. At least one Twitter user managed to bring Westbrook's injury back to Sam Presti, bellowing, "Westbrook is done now? Wow, there you go, Miami. Free championship. Should have kept Harden. Harden and Durant is greater than Westbrook and Durant." In Las Vegas, Oklahoma City's odds to win the championship dropped precipitously overnight. The team had been the favorite to win the Western Conference, but was now suddenly only a co-favorite, as well as a heavy underdog to Miami in the finals, and those odds would continue to fall. Gamblers scrambled to abandon the Thunder. Sam Presti issued a press release. "Russell's health and well-being are obviously our number one priority through this process, and today's procedure helped solidify our belief that Russell will have many productive years of basketball in his future." In a conference call, a reporter asked how Oklahoma City could recover from such a loss. "I don't think we have to rally in any sense," Presti said. "The mentality of the group is in place." For 4 solid years, fans and columnists and TV talking heads had been debating this question in the abstract. How much did this juggernaut of a team, and the city it stood for, depend on the most individualistic individual in the group? Suddenly, it was no longer hypothetical. It would be tested in the actual world. Was Russell Westbrook necessary? We were all about to find out. Are tornadoes necessary? Despite all the ways Oklahoma City had changed throughout its history, from grass to tents to skyscrapers to rubble to renaissance, the sky remained the same. The same wind flowed over every resident who ever lived there, from the prehistoric mound builders to Roscoe Dungee to Wayne Coyne. Every spring, the same storms formed, and tornadoes dropped out of them like monsters. On May 12, 1896, when Oklahoma City was suffering through its 4th consecutive year of drought, 3 separate funnels passed near the town. A photographer managed to capture one on film, the world's earliest known photo of a tornado. It looks essentially modern, an agitation in the upper clouds, with one of them narrowing into a needle of wind, swooping almost elegantly down to probe the houses and power lines. Dark dirt billows up from the ground like an explosion at the point of contact. Similar tornadoes had touched down for centuries before that one, of course, and many thousands have touched down since. But this was the first image that outlasted the storm, the first time people who hadn't been there could see it. It was the beginning of the tornado as media spectacle, the birth, in a way, of Gary England. The walls of England's office were covered with such photos, and they all looked almost exactly like the first. Long before that image was taken, the Plains Indians knew tornadoes well. A Kiowa legend tells that these storms are the result of a beast in the sky, a horse with the tail of a fish. It was born of hubris when an ancient clay sculpture of a horse suddenly came to life. "Well, the horse began to be," writes N. Scott Momaday. "But it was a terrible, terrible thing. It began to writhe. Slowly at first, then faster and faster, until there was a great commotion everywhere. The wind grew up and carried everything away. Great trees were uprooted, and even the buffalo were thrown up into the sky." To this day, the Arapaho people go outside during a tornado to put a specially blessed knife into the ground in its path. This splits the storm, they believe, and sends it safely around their territory. The Cheyenne, similarly, have sacred rituals that allow them to communicate with a tornado. The funnel speaks to them, in their own language, in a voice that sounds like fire. It tells them how big it will be and where it is going. Sometimes they can convince it to turn away from their land. I once asked Gary England why modern meteorology hasn't figured out a way to stop tornadoes. "Why can't we build some kind of barrier? a massive artificial windbreak out near the border of where they usually form, a fake mountain, perhaps, that would shred any large sheet of wind before it could get itself organized. Why can't we shoot missiles or giant tennis balls into the clouds before they start to spin? Surely professional meteorologists, with their encyclopedic knowledge of the ingredients of storms, should be able to come up with a way to tweak conditions to disrupt the worst of them. They're just so friggin' strong, England said. They can have multiple times the energy of a nuclear bomb. A whole thunderstorm is miles and miles and miles across, and it's rotating, and it has its own fuel supply coming into it, this inflow of warm air. How do you stop that? It's going to blow down anything you put in front of it. Someday, maybe some brilliant engineer will come up with a metal that can't be bent, but even then, it would have to be awfully tall, because those storms go from the surface to 40 or 50,000 feet. The most interesting answer is not just that we can't stop tornadoes, but that we shouldn't. This was the answer I got from Greg Carbon, one of the wind geniuses at the Storm Prediction Center in Norman. Why can't we stop tornadoes, I asked. Well, what is the purpose of a tornado, he responded. It had never occurred to me that a storm had anything as grand as a purpose. Consider a hurricane, Carbon said. It acts as a kind of air conditioner for the planet, pushing excess heat from the equator off toward the poles. Similarly, he said, a tornado releases pent-up instability. In the process of that turning, Carbon told me, there's something that the atmosphere is releasing or relaxing. So if you could eliminate tornadoes, what does that mean? How does the atmosphere react to the fact that you've now suppressed this natural phenomenon? It's going to manifest itself in some other way. On this, the Plains Indians and the meteorologists agreed. I spoke with a Cheyenne chief named Gordon Yellowman, who told me that a tornado is not some evil predatory force, nor is it a random assault from a cruel universe with no concern for human life. Every tornado has a job. He keeps us in balance, Yellowman said. He can become very angry when certain things aren't done respectfully or in harmony. It's his job to remind us because we take things for granted. We forget about the power of the forces of nature. Every time he comes, he reminds us of that power. He brings perspective. In times that are particularly agitated, Yellowman said, the storms will only get stronger. We need to be paying attention now, he said. Things are getting more unbalanced and uneven. When we see mass destruction, we'd better be paying attention. We need to learn from one another instead of fighting. Learn. Everyone seemed to agree that the atmosphere, on some level, needs its worst storms. What looks like chaos is, from another perspective, only a return to equilibrium. That is the process. Balance, imbalance, destruction. Balance, imbalance, destruction. Instability is inevitable. There is no point in suppressing or avoiding it. The best a meteorologist can hope to do is to warn people, to figure out as precisely as possible when and where a potentially deadly atmospheric strike might occur, then tell as much of the public as possible, and then everyone just has to help one another. By April, when the NBA playoffs were in full swing and OKC was celebrating the land run, Gary England and every other meteorologist knew the storms were coming. No one could do anything to stop them. All anyone could do was focus and rally and work together to survive whatever eventually arrived. Solo. Timothy McVeigh loaded the truck himself. There were 13 barrels, 8 white, 4 black, 1 blue, and he planned to arrange them in the back of the truck in roughly the shape of the letter T, a formation he had settled on after mapping it out on a kitchen floor with soup cans. It was grueling work. He and Terry Nichols, his old anti-government army buddy, had stockpiled more than 100 bags of fertilizer, and they were heavy. And then there were the 3 big drums of liquid nitromethane, 400 pounds each, a combination that, along with some other odds and ends, would make a weapon violent enough to put the U.S. federal government on notice. possibly even to take it down. McVeigh's fantasy was to kick off a second American Revolution. He was, in his ever-narrowing mind, like a hero in an action movie, and this would be revenge for Waco and all the other injustices he had become increasingly obsessed with as he moved from gun show to gun show, with no real community or psychological help, studying conspiracy theories from the books advertised in the back pages of his gun magazines. McVeigh loaded the truck in Kansas at a storage facility, all alone, because everyone else had failed him. Terry Nichols was flaking out, right at the crucial moment, refusing to show up. McVeigh had tried to lure Michael Fortier, one of his other conspirators, with a sports metaphor. You're like the person who sits on a bench in a basketball game. Somebody comes out of the game, and you come in. But Fortier refused. McVeigh was preparing to cross the threshold that separates paranoid delusion from real-world action. But now others were refusing to join him. McVeigh just kept going. He was used to being alone. He had convinced himself that it was American to be alone. McVeigh and Nichols got along to the extent that they did because they were both obsessed with what they saw as the decline of individual rights in America. They had systematically detached themselves from every community that might have absorbed them. School, work, friends, family, the army. Terry Nichols was a serial loser who deliberately ran up credit card debt without any intention of paying it off. When the bank finally came after him, he sent it a homemade certificate of credit, which he argued was just as valuable as the government's bogus paper money. When the bank took him to court, he refused to recognize the judge's authority over him because he had already renounced his American citizenship. Together, McVeigh and Nichols represented a logical end of radical individualism. What they hated, what they were determined to attack, was not just the U.S. federal government, but the very notion of federation. All of the complications, compromises, and sacrifices required by togetherness. The inevitable mess that came along with being a human among other humans. They were adolescents trapped in adulthood. Their mission was to assert the glory of the heroic individual against the disgrace of collective life. It shouldn't be too surprising that, in the end, they worked so poorly together. But it was hard loading the truck alone. Finally, Nichols showed up, and after McVeigh chewed him out for a while, they worked together to finish loading. By the end of the day, the truck was a rolling bomb. McVeigh could have driven it right then to Oklahoma City, but it wasn't quite the time yet. He was a strong believer in numbers and dates, anniversaries, those magic moments when the big plates of history overlap and bring together radically different temporal worlds. History would align in Oklahoma City. McVeigh would force it into alignment. Together. Ron Norick seemed, somehow, like a fitting mayor for Oklahoma City in the early 1990s. He was not glamorous in any way. He was not photogenic, like his father. He didn't have the sculpted hair and the charming smile. He was bald and round. And, of course, he was not leading a rapidly expanding city in the middle of a post-war boom. He was not struggling to harness the energy of wild growth. Mayor Norick the Younger presided over a city that was in a very sorry state. Downtown was ruined. The economy had not recovered from its bust 10 years earlier, and United Airlines had just rejected a staggering package of incentives in order to avoid making its employees suffer the indignity of living in OKC. Somehow, Mayor Norick's career was not dragged down by the city's misfortune. He was given a chance to make it better. He had good political instincts. After decades of neglect, Oklahoma City's infrastructure was crumbling, and the city could raise no public funds, so Norick announced a program called Adopt a Pothole. For $10, you could sponsor one of the many cavities that plagued the local streets, and the city would fill it. It was the perfect blend of sad and funny, despondent and determined, private and public. The program was picked up in the national news, and people from all over the country sent money to fix OKC's streets. Eventually, in the wake of this success, Norick was able to convince voters to do what a normal city would have done in the first place, to approve bond money to fix the city's infrastructure. Public money for the public good. It hadn't been done in Oklahoma City since the 1970s. In 1991, Norick won re-election with 81% of the vote, and he decided to use this overwhelming political capital to do something grandiose. The city, he knew, couldn't go on this way. It needed something big. But what kind of dramatic vision would also bring sustainable success? How could OKC improve itself without simply chasing another boom? What was the alternative to the grand gamble? Mayor Norick decided to wager his political future on a truly radical idea, an approach completely foreign to the boom mentality. It was not fast or exciting. It was as boring as a field of grass. It went against everything OKC had learned to believe about itself, all the swashbuckling stories of heroic daring and sudden triumph. Norick's solution to Oklahoma City's problems was, sacrilegiously, a public tax. He proposed a voluntary 1 cent sales tax spread over 5 years that would fund a program called Metro Area Projects. MAPS would thoroughly rebuild downtown, infusing much of the energy that urban renewal and the Great Annexation had removed. It would build hotels, sports stadiums, a library, a canal. The dried-up river would be refilled. Culture would be tentatively reintroduced. Downtown would become a real place again, a destination. The mistakes of the previous 40 years would be reversed. "We're trying to create mass," Norick said. "We need to have mass, everything dealing with tourism and sports in one location." Like a Stanley Draper scheme, MAPS was crazily ambitious. Unlike a Draper scheme, however, it would be initiated through official government channels and approved by a formal public vote. The Chamber of Commerce pitched in, funding a PR campaign that urged the people to believe in our future. "Do we compete with other cities?" a flyer asked. "Or do we just stop trying?" MAPS would require, from the people, a leap of faith. The citizens were not naturally inclined to trust the city, for very solid historical reasons. So many grand plans had failed so spectacularly. So much potential had been squandered. OKC in the early 1990s was not really a togetherness place. Its residents were dispersed. Its culture was suburban, individualistic. And even in the best of times, Oklahomans were notoriously anti-tax. Over the previous decade, multiple attempts to impose temporary sales taxes to improve the city had failed. When the people had allowed themselves to be talked into taxes to help lure the airlines had rejected them. In this environment, MAPS was a civic moonshot. Early polls showed 32% support. The Gaylords opposed it, as did the NAACP. Advisors tried to convince Norick to abandon the project, or at least to delay the vote. Mayor Norick said that he would actually prefer not to be mayor than to preside over a place that wouldn't work together to improve itself. He went all over town, speaking to every group he could gather, telling them that he understood that his plan was extravagant, that it was unusual, that its deferred payoff might be frustrating. But to reject it, he argued, would be to give up on OKC's future residents, everyone's children and grandchildren. MAPS was a grown-up thing to do. It was the process. Norick's great strategic gamble was to bundle all 9 major MAPS projects together into a single up or down vote. If you wanted a new library, you had to approve a new minor league baseball stadium. If you wanted water in the river, you had to vote for the new sports arena and the art museum and the hotel. "We've got to roll the dice," Norick said. "We've got to do it all as one. It's all or none, folks." In December 1993, as the date of the vote approached, the city held a downtown rally at the dilapidated convention center. Barry Switzer, longtime football coach at the University of Oklahoma and therefore a local deity, pumped everyone up for maps. "The ball is on the 1-yard line," he shouted. "Let's put it in the end zone, and then we will be number one in the 21st century." The maps vote came on a Tuesday, December 14th, 1993. An hour into the voting, returns showed the new tax trailing 54% to 46. Over the course of the day, however, those percentages began to crawl closer and closer together. And then they actually flipped. Maps won with 54% of the vote. Norick was exultant. "Oklahoma City," he shouted at the watch party in Bricktown. "Welcome to the big leagues." Everyone stood together and cheered. Outside those doors, the city was still bleak and abandoned. Nothing on the ground had actually changed. But now there was hope, flung forward in time. Hope that in 5 or 10 or 15 years, Oklahoma City might be a real place again. Its citizens had agreed, just barely, to sacrifice their immediate interest for the long-term collective good. They would succeed or fail, slowly, together. Game 85. Storms. In the early days of the Thunder, when the team was new, when citizens gathered in the boxy, maps-funded arena only to witness loss after loss after loss, when Sam Presti's process was grinding through its frustrating opening phases, OKC fans believed that bad weather was a good omen. The Thunder seemed to play a little better when it stormed. People would check the season schedule against the weather forecast and watch Gary England and cheer for dark clouds. Over the years, as the team improved, as the gears of the process cranked irreversibly toward glory, this superstition faded. The Thunder were so good that they would blow you out on a perfectly clear afternoon, or in the middle of a hurricane, or during a hailstorm, or when the city was caressed by sweet, gentle breezes. It didn't matter. The Thunder were their own self-contained weather system. So it was fine that, in recent years, the weather in OKC had been relatively mild, that major storms had been sparse. Now, however, there was a basketball emergency. For the first time in the history of the franchise, Russell Westbrook was absent. He would watch the game in civilian clothes, on crutches. What the Thunder would look like without his wild motion, no one could say. They were already down James Harden, a self-inflicted blow. Surely the team couldn't survive the second blow, too. There was a minority opinion that the Thunder might actually function more efficiently without Westbrook, that the remaining players might have to work a little more traditionally, with more sanity and patience, with more respect for the community at large. Durant, in particular, might flourish in this environment. But there was a strain of wishful thinking to such talk. Maybe it was time to renew the old superstition. The team would need luck from somewhere, so why not from the sky? Perhaps the weather gods would speak, once again, just in time, in OKC's favor. As if in solidarity, dark clouds began to gather before Game 3. The series had moved to Houston, and all day, the sky hammered the city with storms. Ropes of lightning whipped down. The rain gushed in sideways, shutting down neighborhoods, forcing drivers to abandon stalled cars on the freeway. Hailstones shattered windows. The roofs of buildings collapsed. An entire hospital had to be evacuated. And indeed, back on the basketball court, the chaotic skies did seem to tilt things the Thunder's way. Kevin Durant started Game 3 on fire, stepping back for unguardable threes, punishing defenders with screaming dunks. It was as if he were not only himself, but Westbrook too. By halftime, he already had 27 points, and OKC held a commanding lead. Then the Rockets came back. Durant went cold. Harden went off. He skittered through defenders, through bullet passes to teammates, calmly stroked in threes himself. He waggled his arms to pump up the crowd. Westbrook watched, motionless, with his crutches, as Houston erased a 20-point deficit. All through the fourth quarter, the game went back and forth. With less than a minute left, the Rockets took the lead. This was exactly the sort of situation in which Westbrook would have charged forward, with his maniacal lack of fear, to do something astonishing, either good or bad, or, more likely, impossible to categorize in traditional human terms. Instead, for the first time ever, with the future on the line, there was only Kevin Durant. Durant dribbled left, far behind the three-point line, probing the defense. Suddenly, impulsively, still hounded by his defender, he rose up to shoot. This was an objectively bad shot. A long, contested three-pointer. Precisely the sort of selfish heave that Westbrook was always launching, the kind of thing the media was always criticizing him for. Sure enough, Kevin Durant missed. The ball caromed hard off the back of the rim. But this was the moment when the old sky magic, the good charm of the bad weather, really kicked in. Durant's shot hit the back of the rim and bounced straight up into the stratosphere, a good 25 feet over the court. It seemed to pause at its apex, then fell back down like a stone, hard and straight, and on its way to the ground, it happened to clip the front of the rim. This sent the ball ricocheting to the back of the rim, which popped it up off the glass, which sent it back to the back of the rim. And then, after this whole ridiculous Rube Goldberg routine, the ball fell softly through the net. The missed shot became, miraculously, a made shot. It was the most circuitous 3 points of Durant's entire career, way beyond anything that might reasonably be called a shooter's role. With that gust of luck, the Thunder regained the lead in the game, and, after Harden threw the ball away on the final possession, they managed to hang on and win. This put them up 3-0 in the series, right on the brink of a sweep. It was a dominant advantage, a lead no team had ever lost before, but it was not at all a dominant feeling. OKC had survived one more night. In the meantime, the atmosphere seemed to have worked out whatever instability it had built up over the previous days. But surely the weather would change. 9:02. April 19th, 1995. Wednesday. An unusually busy morning downtown. Just after 6 a.m., before the sun was even up, nearly 1,300 of Oklahoma City's power players were already on the move, driving down to meet at IMPA's convention center, which was now so run down that people worried its roof might collapse. Drivers with their radios on might have heard Gary England, the official voice of the Oklahoma sky, pop in with his morning forecast. Cool day, clear skies, chance of a big evening storm. City officials, Chamber of Commerce members, oil executives, media personnel, everyone parked as close to the convention center as they could, which wasn't hard, because downtown was almost entirely parking. The mayor's annual prayer breakfast started at 6:45. It was an opportunity for city leaders to ponder all of the many ways in which a close relationship with God could power OKC's civic and corporate good. The special speaker that morning was a Ford executive named Dick Fenstermacher, a curious last name, German for window maker. For the first time in a long time, the feeling downtown was optimistic. The city had been collecting the special map sales tax by then for nearly a year, and the various projects were being planned. The front page of that morning's newspaper carried a story about the different bids being considered for the minor league baseball stadium to be built in Bricktown, the once empty warehouse district. All this growth was still distant and theoretical, and downtown was still stagnant, but at least now it seemed like things wouldn't get any worse. The process had begun. The mayor's prayer breakfast ended at 8:30 a.m. just in time for everyone to head off with supercharged faith to take on the workday. And so the leaders of Oklahoma City scattered throughout downtown, radiating out from the convention center, past the intersection of Broadway and Main, where Angelo Scott once stood on a box to lead his mass meetings, past the jogs in the streets, past the old site of the Biltmore Hotel, past the huge empty lot that was supposed to have been Pei's Grand Mall, past the formerly booming blocks where shoppers had stepped out of streetcars for sandwiches at what used to be Cat's Drugstore and John A. Brown's. As the city leaders scattered into those vacancies, a white van would have been passing through downtown. Inside it was the Orton family, out on its morning routine. Daniel was 4 years old and headed for preschool. The van stopped, first, right in the heart of everything, on Broadway, between the convention center and the Murrah Building. Orton's mother worked for the phone company in a grand old skyscraper on 3rd Street, a product of the city's original oil boom that had survived urban renewal and was now nearly 70 years old. Orton's mother said goodbye and got out of the van. The remaining Ortons drove north, past the Murrah Building, and stopped on 10th Street. This was Daniel's favorite part of the day, Brown's Bakery, where he always ordered a strawberry donut and milk before his dad dropped him off at school. McVeigh's yellow Ryder truck, meanwhile, was heading south. If he had the radio on, he might have heard Gary England, too, back on the air with his 8 o'clock weather report. Cool and clear, possible storms in the evening. McVeigh drove more or less on the route of the land run, on roads planned and executed by Stanley Draper, toward the outskirts of the Great Annexation. He drove with extra caution, paying special attention to the speed limit, avoiding unnecessary attention. A few blocks from Brown's Bakery, Wayne Coyne was inside the compound, sleeping a deep, working-class, middle-American rock star sleep. The Flaming Lips had just flown back from Australia, where they had played a couple of shows with Nine Inch Nails, and Wayne felt completely displaced in time. They were at the exhausting tail end of a long, grueling, acrimonious process of recording their 7th album, Clouds Taste Metallic. 16 hours at a time, holed up in a rundown studio on the bleak edge of downtown, across the street from the city's sewage treatment facility. 2 solid months of late nights, bad food, cigarettes, arguments. The lead guitarist was on the brink of quitting the band. The drummer's heroin habit was growing. Wayne was trying to hold it all together long enough to record the album, which would contain such sing-along classic choruses as All Your Bad Days Will End. But for now, finally, Wayne was sleeping. The yellow Ryder truck kept coming south, at precisely the legal speed limit, a secret pocket of destruction tucked into the usual traffic. At some point on the freeway, a police car pulled up behind it, inexplicably, and followed it for several miles. After 5 minutes or so, however, the policeman sped off somewhere else, and the plot continued rolling forward. Gary England sat up in bed and blinked. He put his headphones back on and got his mic set up. His habit for these early morning radio spots was to call into the station, read out the forecast, then fall backward into bed and go immediately back to sleep until it was time for the next forecast, an hour later. Now it was time for the 9 a.m. crowd. He called into the station and said hello to the producer again. He waited for his colleagues to get everything set up for his introduction. He half-listened to them doing the news, blinking, waiting for his cue. Clear skies, cool morning. Storms coming in the afternoon and evening. Chance of high winds, heavy rain. The scene at the Murrah Building that morning was completely mundane. It was Wednesday. Capable people were dealing competently with tasks. The workers there at that time would have been the punctual ones, the ones who came a little early to make sure everything was in proper working order. The customers they were serving would have been similarly eager, the kind of people who ran errands as soon as the office opened in order to avoid the lines. They said good morning to one another, asked if anything was new. You have a good day. Thanks, you too. All the normal small kindnesses. Out in the middle of nowhere, in the vast northern stretches of the Great Annexation, the Ryder truck officially entered Oklahoma City. As it kept coming south at precisely the speed limit, it passed near Gary England's house on 122nd Street. Minutes later, it was driving down the east side, past Daniel Orton's grandparents' house, past Clara Looper's Freedom Center, past the medical centers and government buildings that had been built on cleared neighborhoods, past Douglas High School and Deep Deuce. When Timothy McVeigh reached downtown, there would have been no traffic to speak of. At the first stoplight he hit, McVeigh put in a pair of green foam earplugs. He drove a little farther, then pulled over and, using a cigarette lighter, started the 5-minute fuse. This produced so much unexpected smoke that McVeigh had to crack the windows, but no one was around to notice. He kept driving. At precisely 8:56:53, a security camera in the lobby of an apartment building captured an image of the truck passing. McVeigh looked like anyone moving into a new apartment, like any guy coming into OKC to take a job in an office somewhere. Shortly afterward, at another stoplight, McVeigh lit the 2-minute fuse. Daniel Orton, at this point, was playing outside. After the donuts, his father had dropped him off, as always, at preschool at Villa Teresa, where Carmelite nuns watched over the children. Daniel was out on the playground. McVeigh cruised east on 5th Street, through the heart of the downtown grid, earplugs in, smoke pouring out the cracked windows. Empty lots, parking garages, bail bond offices, payday loan shops, empty lots. Finally, he reached the Murrah Building, still rising like a 20th century castle in the middle of downtown, its north wall a tall sheet of glass. There was a little drop-off zone directly out front, a recess in the curb for trucks making deliveries. McVeigh pulled in and cut the engine. The Ryder truck was now parked under the building's shimmering wall of glass. Directly on the other side, on the second floor, was America's Kids, a daycare center, where 21 children were settling in for Bible time. The Ryder truck's fuses continued to smoke. McVeigh got out. He started to walk away from the truck and the building, doing his best to seem normal, to walk unremarkably, to not get caught. He could have been anybody. Windbreaker, baseball cap, jeans. McVeigh crossed 5th Street, heading north, not looking back. At 6th Street, he passed a police car, parked, with someone inside it, but he kept moving. He reached an alley and broke into a jog. Right about then, in an office just across the street from the Murrah Building, the Oklahoma Water Resources Board sat down to start its morning meeting. It had a case to settle, the permit request of a local family that wanted to bottle and sell its groundwater. There was a tape recorder running. "This is Wednesday," a woman said, "April the 19th, 1995. McVeigh was approaching the getaway car when it occurred to him that the explosion probably should have happened already. He considered turning back, striding right up to the truck, pulling out his Glock, shooting the bomb directly to make sure it went off. But some force, cowardice or confidence or inertia, kept him jogging down the alley. "This is a hearing for protest of groundwater application number 94501, said the woman running the Water Resources Board meeting. "Basically, there are four elements that I have to, receive information regarding." That was exactly when it happened. At this point in its history, Oklahoma City was familiar with just about every possible kind of explosion. This one, however, was unidentifiable. It was on a whole different scale. All across the spread-out city, people heard the noise and struggled to make sense of it. They thought it was everything except what it was. A gas line exploding, a train rumbling by, a dumpster being dropped, a sonic boom, thunder, a tornado. Wayne Coyne's family had a business downtown, and all of its windows blew out. And their first thought was that an airplane must have crashed outside, in the alley. Daniel Orton's grandfather was sitting at his dining room table, reading the newspaper, when his house started to shake. He thought it was an earthquake, something he'd never felt before. Clara Looper's son, Calvin, figured a jet pilot had come in too hard at Tinker Air Force Base, causing the whole city to boom. So many hundreds of other causes were more likely than what it was. At the Water Resources Board hearing, in the building across the street from the Murrah, the woman speaking about groundwater application number 94501 was interrupted by a thick, rumbling roar, so deep and loud that it overwhelmed the tape recorder's little microphone. It sounds, on the old tape, like 1,000 thunderstorms exploding inside of one another. All of Oklahoma City was filled with that noise. In the meeting, the woman's calm voice turned loud. "Everybody," she screamed. "Let's get out of here, now. Watch the electricity line, out the main door, all the way to your right." Up at the compound, Wayne Coyne sat up in bed. Recently, some houses had blown up in his neighborhood, hot water tanks, unmaintained for years. This, he figured, must have been another of those. He listened for a few seconds, then went back to sleep. Out on the playground of his preschool, a mile north of the Murrah building, 4-year-old Daniel Orton was running around when, out of nowhere, the ground shook violently underneath him. All the windows suddenly blew out of his school building, sending glass flying everywhere, kids screaming, everyone sprinting back into the school to shelter. But Orton went the other way, toward the noise, all the way to the playground's fence. He stared downtown. His mother was down there. Smoke was starting to come up from the center of the city. Gary England, at his home 15 miles north, heard the explosion in double, in his headphones once and then again in real life. He was still on the line with the radio, waiting to do the 9 a.m. forecast. His whole house shook. The producer told him that something bad had just happened, and England ran downstairs, out the front door, to look up at the sky, a habit he'd picked up from many years of reporting the weather. But he couldn't see anything, so he went back inside and turned on the TV. What came out of Timothy McVeigh's Yellow Rider truck that morning was a huge, scorching wind. This wind, more than the fire, was what did most of the damage. It poured out at 7,000 miles per hour, far faster than any wind ever naturally created by the atmosphere of the Earth, more than 20 times faster than wind inside even the fastest tornado. This burning wind slammed instantaneously into the front of the Alfred P. Murrah building, and many of those who died did so in that first blast, in an unimaginably small fraction of time, 1/200th of a second. In only half a second, the wind was gone, replaced by a vacuum, which sucked everything violently back out. These forces were much more than the structure could take. The Murrah building's strength came entirely from its concrete, and the hot wind ripped right through it, turning it to dust. Several crucial supports failed. The floors were jolted violently upward by the bomb, then slammed back down by gravity, and in that motion, they broke and fell. 9 stories popping down on top of one another, heavier and heavier with each floor. Where the Ryder truck had parked was now a 30-foot crater into which people and rubble were falling. Inside the building, there was no time to process anything. Normal life became, without warning or transition or explanation, apocalyptic. Workers were at their desks, clicking into the system, or calling spouses on the phone. They were walking to the coffee machine, or just sitting down to take a computer class. 2 customers had brought their 4-year-old granddaughter to run an errand at the bank on the 3rd floor. A pregnant woman who worked at the DEA was showing co-workers a picture of her recent sonogram. Meetings were being called to order. People were waiting for elevators. It was a normal office building, attacked, without warning, as if it were a military target. People had no way to prepare, and survival was random. In that first moment of chaos, multiple government workers thought that their computers had suddenly blown up in their faces, or that they had fallen asleep at their desks and were only having a nightmare. On the 4th floor, a man was sitting in his chair when he saw a woman across the room suddenly put her arms straight up in the air, and he wondered why anyone would do that. And then he realized it was because the floor was gone, and they were both falling. And when he stopped, he was sitting not on his chair anymore, but on a 3-story pile of rubble. One woman who worked at the bank had just taken out a can of air freshener. Someone with bad body odor had walked by, and the moment she pushed the button, the entire building exploded. She was in a coma for 5 weeks and woke up with this memory. I got to know people in Oklahoma City who would tell me everything about their lives, every inch of the deep history of the city, but they could not talk to me about anything they saw on April 19th, 1995. The bomb shattered the Murrah Building's windows into a storm of broken glass. It filled the atmosphere, shredding everything, driving itself into the walls of neighboring buildings. Glass filled people's shoes. The scope of the damage, the horror of it, is hard to describe. Every vulnerable body part, every soft tissue, was pierced. Everything horrible you can imagine being inflicted on a person happened almost instantaneously. It was one of those disasters where clothing ceases to have meaning. People's shoes were blown off their feet. To this day, some survivors still have slivers of glass embedded in their bodies. The blast was felt 30 miles away. It damaged every single building within 16 blocks, some of them beyond repair. The noise was so huge that, for a few seconds afterward, everything went silent. The first rescuers on the scene heard birdsong. Then the noises of emergency filled the space. Yelling, screaming, muffled cries for help. Car parts burned in the tops of trees and on the roofs of nearby buildings. There was a large parking lot across the street, and now it was full of burning cars, their alarms blaring in insistent loops. And soon the burning cars began to explode, sending a huge column of black smoke into the air. Clear over on the east side, at Calvary Baptist Church, where Clara Looper had started so many of her sit-ins, all the stained glass windows blew out. 5 blocks west of the Murrah Building, at police headquarters, the tile shook so hard and so many windows broke that a policeman named Bill City, sitting in his office, assumed a bomb had gone off in his own building. But papers were raining down all around him, forms, memos, schedules, and City grabbed some out of the air and saw that every single one had come from the federal building. That was how he knew. He got there as fast as he could. In and around the Murrah Building, it was almost impossible to breathe. The formerly clear air suddenly contained all of that pulverized concrete. Survivors emerged from the rubble so covered in dust that you couldn't tell if they were male or female, black or white. Even children had gray hair. Gary England stood in his living room, frozen, watching the TV as the first image of the damage was broadcast. A local news helicopter, out scanning traffic, had been diverted to the Murrah Building. At precisely 9:13, it turned the corner to see the front of the building, where McVeigh had parked his truck. Everyone knew, at that moment, the full extent of things. The north side of the building was gone, and what had survived was shredded, sagging, on the verge of collapse. "Car bomb," England said out loud. It looked exactly like images of terror attacks he had seen broadcast from Lebanon. He stood watching the footage of emergency responders rushing into the building, survivors staggering out covered with dust. England had been down there recently, right there at the Water Resources Board, talking to its employees about how to survive a tornado. And now he was looking at the whole area destroyed on his TV. At one point, as everyone was still processing what was going on, there came news of the threat of another bomb inside the building, and the ruins of the Murrah Building had to be evacuated. And England saw something he would never forget. Randy Renner, one of his very first storm chasers, a friend and colleague, as affable an Oklahoman as you were ever likely to meet. Good old good-natured Randy Renner suddenly came sprinting out of the Murrah Building in obvious terror. England had seen Renner driving toward tornadoes, right into the danger. But now he was running for his life, along with a whole crowd of other people, everyone bracing themselves for the sound of another explosion behind them. In that alien landscape, among the rubble and the chaos, to suddenly see a familiar face, it jarred England, and that image of Randy racing out of the ruined building would pop into his mind again and again for the rest of his life. Even as time moved on, it remained 9:02 downtown. The bomb had frozen wristwatches and wall clocks. Rescuers rushed to the Murrah Building from all over Oklahoma City. A nurse named Rebecca Anderson came from 10 miles away to help victims, only to be struck in the head by falling debris and become a victim herself. She collapsed on the scene and died in the hospital 4 days later. National disaster technicians mobilized to assess the damage. The ruined building was complex and unstable, a whole new horrible landscape, and rescuers had to figure out how to get in and save whatever lives they could. First responders looked for voids, spaces in the rubble, angles of concrete in which people might have survived. They reinforced these cavities with steel braces and wooden beams, listened for muffled voices, and went in again and again. Live electrical wires hung down everywhere. Cold water rose in every depression. Almost immediately, rescuers started to map and name the different zones of the wreckage, the pit, the pile, the forest. From the top of the building hung precarious slabs of concrete, dangling from bent rebar or stretched wires. One huge block was nicknamed the Mother. 32,000 pounds, with rebar sticking out in every direction. Rescuers were constantly aware of it as they worked. Office chairs were used as gurneys. The injured sat or lay in long lines on the sidewalk outside, and medics tagged them according to severity. It was a war zone, the very definition of a triage situation. And some victims were so badly hurt, they had to be allowed to die. Some survivors passed their jackets to others, and people kneeled together to shelter each other from the wind. Timothy McVeigh's bomb hit the daycare center directly, killing 15 of the 21 children. One boy survived because he had been lingering in the bathroom, playing with the water, and the extra infrastructure was just strong enough to hold. The rescuers put themselves in grave danger and saw unimaginable things. One woman was pinned so tightly in the rubble that a doctor had to climb on top of her and with his left hand laboriously amputate her leg at the knee. Rescuers looking up at the crushed floors saw blood dripping through the cracks as if the building itself were bleeding. A firefighter, Chris Fields, arrived minutes after the bombing and was working through triage cases when a policeman approached to say that he had found a baby. Fields took the baby in his arms. He could see, immediately, that she was dead. And the thought passed through his mind that somebody's whole world was about to fall apart. And just at that moment, a photographer took his photo. That image became the symbol of the bombing, published on the front pages of newspapers and magazines all over the world. The Oklahoma City Federal Building, previously unknown outside the city itself, was instantly the talk of the globe. Its image broke into scheduled programming everywhere. Local stations started to broadcast from the scene without commercial interruption. The big network's celebrity anchors mobilized to OKC. 100 TV crews took up semi-permanent residence at a nearby intersection, with so many trucks that the spot became known as Satellite City. One of the happiest memories of Daniel Orton's life remains the moment, sometime after the noise, when his mother and father, both of them, walked through the door of his preschool to pick him up. Wayne Coyne woke up properly later that morning when the phone rang, and it was Michelle's mother, who worked in a building downtown. Things were blowing up, she said, and no one was being allowed to leave. At the compound, they turned on the TV, and Wayne stood there watching the images of the center of the city burning, the most familiar place in the world, the landscape of his whole life, looking suddenly foreign. It felt surreal, and then it occurred to him that he was actually only a few minutes away from the reality of it. So he got on his bike and rode south, through the nameless neighborhoods of his childhood, the places where nothing ever happened, until, after a few minutes, he reached the actual place, in person, that he had just been watching on TV. The scene looked strangely familiar, like things he had seen all his life. Neighborhoods turned inside out by tornadoes, skyscrapers knocked down by wrecking crews. Wayne felt terrible for all the people involved, but he did not feel involved himself. It felt strangely personal, but also far away. He was suddenly right in the center of the world, but also removed from what was happening. He watched for a while, and then he rode back home. It was spring in Oklahoma, and the weather didn't stop. Gary England's morning forecast turned out to be correct. That afternoon, as the rescue crews worked to extract survivors, serious thunderstorms formed in the sky, and as evening fell, they erupted, drenching everything, soaking everyone, gusting wind so hard that the ruins started to rock, threatening to collapse. The hanging concrete blocks, including the mother, swung back and forth on their strands of rebar. A tornado watch went into effect. Lightning flashed. Eventually, rescuers knocked holes in the back wall of the ruins to try to let the wind pass through. In the midst of all this, the sun set. Rescue work went on by spotlight. That evening, rescuers heard a faint cry deep in the rubble, right under a cluster of hanging concrete chunks. They called for quiet. It was a girl's voice, emanating from underneath 4 feet of rubble, calling out that she couldn't breathe. A doctor was able to reach down and hold her hand while firefighters dug for hours until they found her, still alive. She was 15 years old. She had been at the Social Security office. No one knew it then, but she would be the final survivor. After that, no more voices came from the building. The task became mainly to remove those who had died. Emergency crews searched the rubble systematically with fiber optic cameras and acoustic listening devices, using a technique called checkerboarding, clearing and searching 14-foot squares. What they found was so terrible that some workers had Vietnam flashbacks. Even the rescue dogs became visibly depressed. The search went on for more than 2 weeks, until every accessible inch of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building had been analyzed. On May 4th, just before midnight, the rescue operation officially stopped. In the final accounting, 168 people had died. 219 children had lost a parent. 30 were orphaned completely. More than 500 people were injured, many severely, in ways that would never fully heal. Clara Looper's radio show, 3 days after the bombing, felt like a church service. She expressed her grief out loud, in public. She wept. She repeated, over and over, a rhythmic refrain. It happened in the heartland of America. She asked the people of the East to bring food and supplies to the Freedom Center, canned goods, diapers, dog food, safety glasses, baby food, deodorant, raincoats, soap, flashlights, lotion, anything that might help the rescue workers. She lauded the nobility of the dead and injured, these hard-working people that went to work on time. One of Calvin Looper's old fraternity brothers, Clarence Wilson, had been an attorney at HUD on the Murrah Building's 8th floor. During Black History Month, Clara Looper had gone there to speak to all the employees, and the memory of it now drove her to despair. "I knew those people," she said. "Those were my friends. But now Clarence is gone." "No, Mama," said Calvin. Calvin was still trying to believe that Clarence might only be missing, or might still be alive in the rubble. "Oh, my God," Clara went on. "Not only Clarence, all of those workers, and those little children. How could anybody do it?" "Oh, it's an emptiness," she moaned. "An emptiness. What is it like? It's like looking up to the sky, and there's no sky. It's like looking at the fields, and there's no grass." At the end of the show, she signed off, simply, with, "This is Clara Looper, saying, I love you." Justice. Every time a new player joins the Oklahoma City Thunder, before he ever plays a game, he's required to go downtown and take a tour of the bombing memorial. He sees the twisted axle of Timothy McVeigh's demolished Ryder truck, still labeled with evidence tags from the investigation. He sees stopped clocks and broken coffee mugs. He walks among the 168 bronze and glass chairs, arranged in neat rows inside the footprint of the missing building, each chair inscribed with the name of one of the dead. He walks around the reflecting pool on the space that was once 5th Street and along the chain-link fence outside, where people still come from all over the world to leave photos, poems, and stuffed animals. He sees the survivor tree, a gnarled